Hi, my name is Erin Tillman. I'm a dating empowerment coach, speaker, and author known as the Dating Advice Girl. For over 10 years, I've been empowering and coaching singles by helping them improve their social skills, communication skills, and get clear on their dating goals and objectives. Relationships are not one size fits all, but basic consent and respect are important parts of the dating process in order to have an exciting and meaningful connection with others. Listen, learn, and laugh with me on this journey of sex-positive self-discovery. Thanks for listening. Well, I am back with another amazing guest on the Dating Advice Girl podcast. And so we're with another friend and colleague. I can't remember how or when we met. Dr. Hernando Chavez. Let's just jump into it. But it's been, I feel like we've been in each other's sphere for a few years, 5 years, 6 years.
I feel like we see each other at conferences and events, and we're always just intermingling.
Completely. Yay, and I got him on the podcast. Yay. So who is this I'm talking about? Well, let me tell you. Here we go. Okay. Dr. Hernando Chavez holds a BA in psychology from the University of California, Santa Barbara, an MA in marital and family therapy from University of San Diego, a DHS doctorate in human sexuality from the Institute of Advanced Study of Human Sexuality as well. See, this is why I like to associate with people who are super accomplished, like Dr. Hernando. This is great. I mean, he really does know his stuff. He's a licensed marriage and family therapist in California, specializing in intimacy, relational difficulties, sexual concerns and dysfunctions, and with the sexual minority communities like the LGBTQ community, the BDSM community, fetish, sex work, non-monogamy communities. You also teach at East LA College in Pepperdine, which I didn't know. We talked about that before. I wish I would have known that because I spoke there last year, I could have been like, hey, Dr. Hernando. And has written for AskMen.com, Sexpert.com, oh my gosh, Marie Claire, The Guardian, Rolling Stone, Bustle, Vice, Maxim, Men's Health. Oh my gosh, Dr. Hernando Chavez, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
I'm excited to have you here. You know, I was just saying, you know, I think it's really, this has come up a lot in conversation, actually, both personally and professionally, that there is a learning curve with so many things that we personally work with, you know, with whether it's dating, consent, sex, all the things. It's like there's a lot of things we assume people know about things. And where do you learn about them, right? It's like we're very lucky that that a lot of our friends are really interested in all of these subjects too. So a lot of our conversations, our normal conversations, quote unquote, are like kind of geeking out about, you know, all these things related to all these topics. So it's really interesting. So for the show, for everyone listening, I try to bring it to you without too much, just in a boiled down way. So it's digestible, you know, so we can all be on the same page. So let's jump right in. So we kind of jumped into it with your bio, but what's your area of expertise in layman's terms?
So my education and therapy, they intersect in that I teach and I do a lot of public presentations. So mm-hmm. Typically you'll find folks that don't have a lot of sex ed backgrounds or a lot of information they've been exposed to. So you have to break it down in a very basic manner, kind of give them exposure, maybe introductory kind of material, which keeps me humble because it reminds me of how much people need this information and how little is actually being offered in families and in schools and just in culture in general. Mm-hmm. The other half of my practice professional work is therapy. And so I work with people with some sexual difficulties. It could be individual or couples or families. Typically, I work a lot with non-monogamy communities, kink communities. And a lot of times, those folks don't have a lot of issues around their sexual identity. Mm-hmm. Many times, they want somebody who just gets them, who knows their community, and then they want to work on some mental health concerns. So sometimes you find folks coming out gay, coming out kinky, coming out non-monogamous, and those are really enjoyable to work with because you can see that growth. You can see that, like, the progression of people learning and gaining awareness and creating insight and then, like, developing these skills and relationships that they didn't have before. So it's a beautiful thing to just see people grow.
You know, I love it, too. I mean, all I want is to be in a world where everyone can live their truth and really feel confident living the way that they want to live, right? And love who they want to love, et cetera, et cetera. Why did you decide to go a non-traditional route in terms of your practice? You know, because I think there's, I mean, for me, when I think of therapist, I think, oh boy, I'm nervous to talk to them. They might judge, you know, the way I live my life. And I've personally I can't say that I've actually not had too many therapists in my life professionally, but like in terms of going to a therapist, but a lot of people I know have been to therapists and they felt worse after they've gone to them because they felt like you're wrong for feeling a certain way. You're wrong for wanting to be in, you know, a non-monogamous relationship or those things. So what made you want to go that route in terms of what you do?
Yeah, you know, right when you said that about therapists in the past making you feel wrong about something, that already kind of like stirred something up within me, because I don't think it's our role to tell you what you should do, to tell you right and wrong. It's our job to ask questions to help you explore maybe your version of what is right and wrong, and explore how it's impacting you and how it's affecting your life, your relationships, your happiness. Like, I'm a big believer in a couple concepts. The authenticity movement, where trying to be authentic of what is internally experienced within the self and also how we live our life externally and with the world. I think it's important for us to have as much congruence as possible to a certain degree. It doesn't always have to be public. It can even be private, but congruence will typically reduce the internal conflict. So I think that helps with reduced anxiety, reduced shame, reduced, you know, no one wants to live a life with those things, you know, being carried. But I also find too that it's really valuable for people to also seek out happiness. Like, many times clinicians don't ask questions like, what makes you happy in life? What makes you feel most sexual? What makes you feel most desire? Like, you've got to look at things from a positive lens. Like, you can't just go see clinicians where it's just about our problems and our challenges and our difficulties and our insecurities and inferiorities. I think that that's part of it. But I also want to learn about people. Like, what makes you tick? What do you dream about? What do you aspire to? Years ago, I was exposed to something called Ikigai. It's Ikigai, which is a concept in Japan. It sort of means the translation is like the reason for being, the reason for who you are. It's like your purpose. And they've got this wonderful, you can type this out on Google and see this beautiful diagram of four different parts where people learn to find sort of this balance between what they're good at, what they can monetize.
It's like a Venn diagram?
It's like a Venn diagram.
Yeah, I love Venn diagrams. Anyway,
you know what? I don't think a lot of us do that. A lot of us don't know what our purpose is. You know, if your purpose is healing, how are you sort of progressing that? If your purpose is personal growth, you know, how are you working towards that? I just feel like a lot of us don't always have the space or the opportunity or even the time or resources to really do that personal growth.
No, it's so true. And, you know, like you said, if there's someone in your life, like a coach or therapist, who's there to help you on that journey, hopefully there's not judgment in that, you know, with that coaching, that coach or therapist. And I feel like so many times there is. So I just want to say thank you for being who you are and embracing your clients and not trying to change them, you know.
I'm trying. Yeah, I think they'll change themselves.
Yeah.
I'm here to support it. Yay.
Okay, so why do you think, I mean, there's so many reasons. I can't wait to hear what you're going to say. Why do you feel like there's so much shame when specifically talking about sex? Huge question.
It's a broad question. We'll never tackle it all in just a quick conversation, but I think a lot of it has to do with the culture that we expose ourselves to. If it's a sex-negative, shame-inducing culture around sex, you're going to find that the media, social constructs like family or religion or peer groups or schools, they're all going to contribute to this negativity around sex, or this idea that sex is bad or sex is wrong. And there's a moral sort of judgment around it. And therefore, it's going to start instilling guilt on the, you know, of from our behavioral perspectives, and then it'll start seeping inside to create the internal shame that makes us feel bad about who we are. And that's where we see a lot of people struggling with this tug of war inside between who they know they are or want to be and who they feel like society expects them to be. And so many folks are going through that they don't want to let out their real self, because they're afraid it's going to not be accepted in society. It's going to be judged. It's going to disappoint parents. It's going to get them ostracized or ridiculed, or people won't love or accept them in relationships. And so I do find that there's just a lot of messages and cultures that will really instill some shame within people.
Yeah, and, you know, I feel like, to piggyback on that, you know, I think we're very lucky that we chose to do what we do professionally, but we're so lucky in that it almost gives, like, people are like, whatever we're choosing in our lives, like, it's like people are like, oh yeah, we get it, you know, she's a dating coach, yeah, of course she's gonna do whatever she's doing, you know, of course she's gonna have different kinds of relationships and things outside of the box. Like, it's, I feel very lucky that I'm less judged in a way, like, you know, certain professions especially, it's like, it's a whole like shame zone of like, I can't tell anyone, I gotta hide who I am, you know. So crazy.
You know, when we all get together, for those of you listening, when sex educators and sex therapists get together, there's a lot of sexual discourse and a lot of just talk and and we support each other. You know, somebody will say, oh, wow, I just tried this new kink. You know, I couldn't believe it. And all of a sudden, everyone's like, that's awesome. That's amazing. Good for you. Or, you know, I tried this new sex toy, and it was gave me this mind-blowing orgasm. And all of a sudden, everyone's like, high five. Good for you.
Right.
This encouragement in this subculture really helps provide normalization, empowerment, comfort, confidence. I mean, if we only could expand that to the rest of the world, mm-hmm. I think you'd find just a lot of people happier with their bodies, with their sex lives, with their relationships.
Yeah.
And if they aren't experiencing that happiness, at least they might be more equipped to address maybe some of the challenges, you know, a little bit more fearless and a little bit less anxious towards facing those things.
Yeah, I mean, that actually leads into my next question of what are ways we can normalize talking about sex and things associated with it? I mean, you know, the phrase, I don't love this phrase, but finding your tribe comes to me kind of like what you're talking about in terms of our colleagues and friends. And, you know, I think it can be really hard, you know, coming from a small town in Ohio, it can be very difficult if you're in a geographical area where it's harder to find people. I do feel like for better or for worse, the internet and social media and stuff can be very helpful in that way. You can find people. Like, I mean, we were growing up. I mean, I'm like in some, like, I'm in the, like, this middle generation. There's like a 4-year generation that's like between Gen X and Gen Z or something, and I'm in it. And we're the ones that remember pre-internet and pre-computer and post. We're like the last generation that remembers that. And like, yeah, so back in the day, I mean, there was no way to meet other people. I think like, I'm going back to like a Yahoo chat room or something, like the first things where the internet was used to like talk to people, right? And so like these generations now, and even our generations, it's like there's so much at our fingertips now, right? So we are very lucky. But finding your tribe, I'm totally off track. I'm just going on a whole tangent. But yeah, I mean, are there any other things you can think of that can help normalize talking about sex and dysfunction around sex, to be honest?
I think it's twofold, and I think that comprehensive sex ed starting at an early age is our ultimate goal. Mm-hmm. That would be where we could start. If you look at cultures like Sweden or Germany, or even, you know, one of the great spots for comprehensive sex ed, which is Holland, you see them starting at very young ages, exposing them to very age-appropriate sex ed, mm-hmm. body autonomy, decision-making, you know, communication. And then you get into more sort of progressive sort of topics later on.
Mm-hmm.
But they address it. They face it. And you find that there's less shame in their cultures. There's also sort of lower rates of sexual assault, sexual rape. You know, there's more of a egalitarian sort of attitude. So you'll see there's a lot of benefits towards starting early.
Yeah.
Now, that's in an ideal world, if we could do that in this country. But the reality is that we have a lot of abstinence-only sex ed or sex ed. Which
right.
is, fucking people up, to be
yeah,
honest.
Absolutely.
So I encourage anybody here who had that upbringing to face it as an adult, to take a sex ed class or a human sexuality course at a school. Even
they
if
can be really fun.
They can be fun. they can stir up some great stuff within the self, but we've got to do our own work. We've got to seek out books and resources, podcasts like this one, and try to educate ourselves and, I guess, undo the lack of education of the experience that produced a lot of shame in our childhoods and create something different for our adulthoods. Because a lot of us, you see it happening all the time. People are just looking to undo the damage that was done early on.
Yeah. No, absolutely. You know, and it's interesting because, you know, since you're a professor and teach college students, you know, it's funny because it came up the other day. It's kind of related, but kind of not. And somebody was saying, oh, wow, like consent. That's very interesting. Those millennials or those post-millennials, like, they don't get it. And I said, I'm sorry. I said, I got to be, no, I can't wait to hear what you're going to say because you're around them way more than I am, that age group. But in my experiences, the post-millennials actually, even though they're not perfect, they still get it. And they're way more open to hearing new things about things. Whereas I've had more pushback, especially when my book was released last year, more pushback from people in, like, say, the boomer category age group, because it's like, what? I have to change my behavior. What? Like, the way we did things, like, why can't I just do things the way I always did? And that's not gender specific either. All genders, it just seemed like boomer generation around that, it was just really hard for them to grasp a new concept and learn something new. And so I'm like, I say this all the time about so many things, but I'm like, I look to the kids. I'm like, the kids, they're not perfect, but they're trying, and they're more open. They're open to learning. And so if we could all get to a place of just being more open to hearing a new perspective, or that maybe the way we did something might have like hurt people, or maybe there's a better way, or just integrating new things. I think that would be helpful in terms of learning curves and things, you know?
I think it's inevitable that older generations will have some resistance to change because it took them time to learn a certain way.
Right.
And it isn't easy to relearn or to unlearn something. I experienced that too as well with the observation you're making, which is younger generations seem to have a lot more of an orientation fluidity, a gender fluidity,
totally.
An acceptance towards unique sexual identities, much more than maybe older generations have because they've been exposed to it early on and they've had a longer learning curve, if you will. I also find too that from a consent perspective, I do see a lot more awareness and discussion around consent because it's being discussed now and it's being talked about, and it's in the midst of their, like, in the prime of their dating sort of lives.
Yes.
Older adults who might have been partnered for a long time or may have not really had to been exposed to having to understand there's nuances to dating and to talking and communicating, to proposing sex and being sexual people. They oftentimes haven't had that that learning curve. So
yeah,
I see a lot more in the younger generations. I turn to them as well too, just to sort of check myself to see, wow, am I actually progressive or am I being a little bit inflexible and maybe behind the times?
Yeah. Same. Look to the kids. I mean, seriously. I guess piggybacking on that, not really, let's just change the subject, here we go, because there's never enough time, I'm very long-winded, here we go. Are there any common dating or relationship or specifically sex questions your clients have without breaking some confidentiality? Is there any sort of through line or consistent thing that you're asked?
You know, I think people come in for a lot of similar things, but a lot of people want to have the change in the relationship done by somebody else. And so oftentimes I encourage them, look, you're in the room and your partner isn't, or maybe they both are, but I encourage each of those people or multiple people in multiple relationships, be the catalyst to your own change, that you're not going to be able to change other people. You can ask them to change. You can express what is your expectations or your needs in relationships, but it's going to be their job to do their own change. And I encourage people to do that themselves. So what I see a lot of is folks needing to work on themselves. And I think that personal growth is a lifelong journey. It should never stop. It is a constant experience. And a lot of folks check out, you know, they don't know they're raising kids or they're working hard at work and trying to climb the ladder of success. There are people that will say, oh, I haven't read a self-help book in years, or I haven't really, you know, done anything to really work on me and who I am.
Yeah.
So I see a lot of folks benefiting from working on the communication, working on how to be healthy or what is a healthy relationship, working on things like what are boundaries in my relationship?
Yes.
What are the expectations I have? What are the needs that I have for relationships? I typically find a lot of my clients, they have poor partner selection. And what I mean by that is we pick people that are not best suited for success for our version of a healthy relationship.
Oh, that's so deep. Go on.
Yeah, so like if my needs are, I need somebody who creates security, somebody who's a good communicator, somebody who's open-minded, somebody who instills trust, and then I choose a partner who has narcissistic qualities, who has a history of infidelity and has cheated on me as well, and I'm trying to get back together with them, there's an incongruency with what you're needing and also who you've been choosing to try to create a relationship with that.
Yeah.
I do believe people can change. You know, I'm a big believer in that, but I think people also have to be more than just talking about change. They have to actually be going through it and doing it and showing that they're invested in that process. So partner selection is a big one that I see a lot of in my practice.
Woo! Dr. Hernando, seriously, that's deep. That one, like, really resonates with me. You know, it's like, I feel like a lot of us could be with certain people in theory, but couldn't necessarily, but they might not, like you said, might not be the best choice for us. And it also, I just feel like, I think about this a lot. I feel like when you're a certain way when you meet somebody, and, you know, a lot of us do evolve, right? And so it's interesting sometimes to see if, you know, the partner you've chosen is going to be okay with your evolution, or if you're going to evolve at a similar pace, or wherever you end up in terms of your evolution, like, are you still on the same page, you know, or are you able to embrace who that person is now, you know?
Oh. In personality psychology, there's this one particular there's something called the Big Five personality traits. It's like five main traits that everybody has, and it's called agreeableness. And look what it is, it's like the spectrum between flexible and inflexible, People who are adaptable versus not adaptable.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's a really important quality. I want to see a person in my life who can go with the flow, who can adapt, who can change, who can, like, you know, if we have to cancel plans or if there's a little hiccup that's happening on a trip, they don't, you know, lose it or they don't sort of crumble. Because those are the folks that are going to be able to support your change. And vice versa, I've got to be that person. I've got to have a strong sense of agreeableness to support someone else's evolution.
Yeah.
Because we're all fluid. We're all going to be evolving. It's going to be a dynamic growth process in life. If you pick somebody really rigid or very inflexible, it may make more challenges down the road with the changes that you're probably going to make.
Wow, that's so deep. This is so great. Like, literally, like, I don't even know. That's going to be the highlight of the interview. And by the way, when I promote it, I'll, like, take sound bites. That's the sound bite. That's so good. So, okay, we're out of time because there's never enough time, never. Do you have, like, I think it kind of did just give one tip. Choose your partners wisely. I was going to say, is there any general advice you could give to an individual to help improve their relationships or maybe their selection of a partner, maybe?
You know, there's a couple of things that I guess I would encourage people to do is, you know, we sometimes talk about opposites attract. And that does entice us. That is novel. That is, you know, sort of catch our attention. But for long-term relationships, typically we find that similarities are a lot more beneficial and a lot more of a glue that holds us together.
Mm-hmm.
So finding somebody that has similar belief systems, similar attitudes, similar hobbies, it doesn't always mean that they have to be 100% coinciding, but typically you'll find similarities, make the world go round, and offer a better opportunity for long-term relationships to succeed. And then going back to the idea of partner selection, I encourage people to sit down, write down your needs as an individual.
Yes, write it down.
Your needs in a relationship.
Yeah.
Your needs for a partner.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean we have to be rigid and everybody has to fit into this perfect sort of, you know, list or template.
Mm-hmm.
But it does mean that if we're noticing that the people I choose don't match up very well with the needs that I have, am I shooting myself in the foot when it comes to dating and relationships?
Right.
Are there deal breakers? I mean, are there red flags that we are not acknowledging that are existing? If I don't want to have children and I start dating somebody who does want to have children,
oof,
where is that going to go?
Right.
I mean, we can love each other, we can have great sex together,
yep,
but eventually it's going to get to a place where we're going to start having an impasse.
Right.
You got to start looking ahead and picking people that are sort of both part of, like, the community that you are, but also have similar values and sort of future beliefs that you have.
Future beliefs. Yeah, I do feel like it's human nature sometimes to want to change people. Or, like, because I feel like a lot of times people, I mean, unless someone's a narcissist, right? But if I feel like a lot of times people do tell us who they are and tell us what they want. And then maybe sometimes, because we really want someone to be something, like, we're like, oh, maybe they'll change their mind later. Maybe I can, you know, convince them.
I've had people in the past say, you're not jealous enough that in their past, jealousy was how they felt somebody loved or cared
for
them.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm not going to change and become something that doesn't feel right for
me. Yeah.
That all of us are, if we can find our closest authentic self, that I think we have to find people that match well with that.
Yeah.
Also have their version and the two of us sort of coexist well together.
Yeah, I agree. Well said. We're all wrapping it up. The phrase that came up recently for me was, I'm a very social person, but I have to be very selective about who's in my inner circle. Because I can pretty much be friends with anyone. I've gone on dates with all kinds of different people, which was fun. I had a good time, have a good time meeting all kinds of people. But in terms of inner circle, that's where you have to be real selective, I think, you know?
Real selective, and it's not easy because there are people that can get close to us, and they turn out to be different people.
Emotional
vampires. Maybe they're toxic. Maybe they have a lot of, it affects our life in a negative way, or it affects our happiness. And so this is where I think our empowerment, our boundaries, our assertiveness comes into play, because we cannot keep people in our close circles that are harmful to us.
Yeah.
Way too many people, like, whether they want to fight to make something that's not working work because of their own competitiveness or their own sort of stubbornness, whatever it may be, sometimes letting go of something that's painful or hurtful to your life is actually what is going to open the door to something better down the road.
Oh, 1,000,000%. I love it. It's the best way to end this. That was really great. Well, yes. One door closes, another door opens. So good. So, Dr. Hernando Chavez, please tell us where we can find out more about you. Website, social media, all the things.
Sure. All my social media is at Hernando_Chavez, and it ends with an S. And my website is drhernandochavez.com. And you can find me if you just type me in. I'm sure I'll pop up. And I really appreciate you having me.
Oh my gosh, no, this was so great. You're so great. I had so many aha moments during this brief interview. So thanks for being here.
And now it's time for the Consent Corner. Tips, advice, and insights from my book, The Consent Guidebook. Chapter 6, Emotional Intelligence and Consent Comprehension. We all have different levels of emotional intelligence and different levels of comprehension where boundaries are concerned. Consent is a very new concept for some. If you have a high level of consent comprehension, someone who is just learning about the idea of consent or might be having trouble understanding the importance of consent might not be a good fit for you. It can be difficult to come to terms with the fact that the potential new partner who we are excited about might not be on the same page. It's important to acknowledge that some individuals might not be a good fit for you. If you do see potential in someone and choose to invest time and energy to teach them or support them through the learning process, be kind and support them through as they learn new concepts and ideas. It's important that you be honest with yourself about how much time and energy you are willing to devote to their comprehension of personal boundaries and specifically respecting your boundaries. Be clear about what your emotional needs are and weed out people who are not on the same emotional level. Choosing partners who have a similar level of emotional maturity can lessen misunderstandings. Your intuition can help guide you through the process of figuring out if you and a potential partner have different emotional needs. Never disrespect someone because they aren't on the same level of comprehension. Their lack of understanding is not necessarily malicious. It might just mean that you have more knowledge and/or awareness around personal boundaries. There can be a learning curve regarding consent. If someone you would like to spend more time with is truly trying to understand, give them some time to process the shift in interpersonal interaction. If while supporting your potential new partner in their journey to fully understand the concept of consent, you discover that fundamental differences still remain in the way you communicate, show respect, and process the idea of consent, it might be time to let them go as a potential intimate partner. If you do walk away, do so knowing that you gave this interaction a good try, and even though the end result might not be what you had planned, you aided someone in their consent educational journey. The Consent Guidebook is available in paperback and ebook on Amazon, Google Books, iBook, and wherever ebooks are sold. For more info, go to theconsentguidebook.com.